Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. Andrew, what am I supposed to say, though?
Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective.
And what else am I supposed to say?
You're supposed to say subscribe, rate, and review, because we definitely need those things.
Can I just say that I'm a very avid podcast listener, but I don't subscribe to any podcasts. When I want them, I just go get them.
He doesn't want to subscribe to any podcast who would have him as a listener.
That's right. And so I don't understand why subscribing. I think this whole metric is flawed. And I was an early podcast adopter many, many years ago. And yet I am judged. Is my listenership not valid to anybody because I don't subscribe to these podcasts? I'll have you know I don't subscribe to this podcast. How about that?
You should subscribe to this one.
Well, you really should. Definitely do that. Much more convenient, Brian.
All right. Thank you, Andrew. We have a couple of West Coast guys joining us today, in addition to Andrew. Up in Seattle is Kevin Pelton. Kevin, good morning.
Hey, good to be back.
And we have in Los Angeles, Kevin Arnovitz. So we have Arnovitz and Pelton, two Kevins. So I don't want to be sort of flippant, but I'm going to address you by your last names during this podcast.
Just address me as Shlomo today.
Shlomo. Svi. I'm going to call you Svi.
Svi. Yes.
So this is something that you guys have done in the past. This is my first experience with it. We're calling it small sample size theater. Because most teams are about 12 to 14 games in, still a little early, although some teams are making some pretty big decisions, such as, you know, trading star players and cutting guys like Carmelo Anthony. Pelton, I'm going to start with you. So far, as you look at things in the small sample size theater, what are some of the things that are jumping out to you?
Well, maybe we should start with kind of the general league-wide trend, which, you know, obviously in the first few days of the season, everyone was marveling at how many points per game the league was scoring. It was up, I think, when I wrote about it, after the first weekend of the season, over 113 points per game, which at that point was going to be the most we had seen since the 1960s. And lo and behold, that even though scoring generally tends to improve a little bit over the course of the season, that has proven to be a small sample size fluke to some extent, as it's down now to 110.7 points per game, which would still be, you know, the most we've seen in the post-merger era, but no longer by nearly the same kind of scale.
What was it last year? Do you know off the top of your head?
Let's see. It finished last year at 106.3.
So that's still a pretty big jump year over year.
Okay. Yeah, especially because of the fact. I mean, the one interesting question is how much it's going to continue to keep coming down. Again, that's not the trend. Usually it gets higher over the course of the season. And, you know, if you look at compared to where we were through the same number of games or the same date last year, it was at 105.7 points per game. So that's still a 5-point jump. But it doesn't, you know, at one point the idea was, okay, well, scores in the 130s are going to become the new normal. And I don't think that's going to be the case anymore.
Hey, so, Kevin, is the league shooting the three better? Are they shooting the two better? I mean, where is it just a possession thing, or actually guys are better at shooting the basketball?
It has been a little of both in terms of the pace increasing and efficiency increasing. If you look again compared to this same date last year, pace in terms of possessions per game is up about 2.6%, but then offensive efficiency per 100 possessions is up about 2%. And hot three-point shooting was kind of a factor in this early, but, you know, now it's back down at 35%, which is a percentage point lower than it was at the end of last year. That's one of those categories that'll probably improve over the course of the season. Pace tends to come down. Teams tend to slow down.
But see, that doesn't surprise me, Kevin, because I feel like more people are shooting threes, and maybe not all of them should be shooting threes. So while I'm not surprised about the volume of 3-point shooting going up, the Aaron Baineses of the world chucking 3 and 4 a game may not be smart. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the percentage fall, but the volume to go up. That's just, you know, anecdotal.
Yeah, I think it's going to end up pretty similar. I mean, that's kind of one of the fascinating takeaways of the 3-point evolution is that the percentage that the league as a whole makes has generally been pretty flat since they moved the line back in, or back out rather, 2 decades ago. And what really tends to change, what's really changed is, you know, basically teams are able to attempt a lot more shots now while still making somewhere in the range of 35% of them.
So you would say that three-point shooting over the years has not actually improved, just the amount of guys who are shooting 35%.
Right. So, I mean, effectively it has improved because you're taking increasingly more difficult shots, especially the last few years as we've seen the rise of, you know, a bunch of players shooting threes off the dribble at a high volume following Steph Curry's lead. But the actual accuracy has stayed in the same range.
Okay, Mr. Arnovitz, what for you? Is there anything that for you that stood out so far that fits our small sample size theater model?
Yeah, like I'm always interested in the teams that are they overperforming? Is this real? Is this a fluke? Are they going to come down to earth? Or are they the 2014-15 Warriors, right? I mean, you know, is this sustainable? So, like, you know, like I look at a Denver team that's, yeah, I think this morning, is it third in defensive efficiency? No, they've dropped to fourth by a tenth of a point. But, like, this is what we know about the Denver Nuggets of recent years. They were 23rd last year. They were 29th the year before. I mean, basically, the book, as we know, on this incarnation of the Denver Nuggets is really interesting young team, but can't defend. They get Paul Millsap back, so, like, that's real, because Paul Millsap's a great defender. He's versatile, he's strong, he can defend multiple positions. But, like, is he, let's raise the team from 23rd to 3rd good? So, Kevin Pelton, are the Denver Nuggets going to be a top 5 or even a top 10 defensive team this season? Is that small sample size theater, or is that, like, a big old production that's going to run for many years?
Yeah, I would say that's probably more small sample size theater than it is something that's going to be sustainable. And, you know, they were much higher a couple games ago, even though they haven't dropped far in terms of the rankings. They're much closer to the rest of the pack. And then offense, you know, kind of it's weird because I don't think that their start was fluky. I think that how they were succeeding at the start of the season was fluky, because we think of them as this all offense, no defense team. And that's, you know, maybe a little unfair with Millsap. I think they
that is the ghost of Doug Moe in our consciousness, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. My expectation was that they could be maybe average on defense this year and top 5 on offense, and that would be a pretty potent combination. And I still think that's probably what we're looking at, because, you know, in terms of, so one thing I'm looking at a lot early in the season is the second spectrum data that we have access to at ESPN. You have your shot quality kind of based on where the shots are taken, what kind of shots they are, and then how close nearby defenders are. And Denver at the early part of the season was really underperforming their shot quality on offense while overperforming it on defense. And we've started to see those two even out a little bit over the last few games.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned Doug Moe, Kevin, because Doug Moe does not get the credit that he should from modern NBA fans. When was he the head coach? Was it the early 80s?
Yeah.
And, you know, this team's played in Denver. He thought they had an altitude advantage, and so he wanted to play up-tempo. He didn't – I don't think he framed it as points per possession like people do today to explain the math. But one of the things that Doug Moe tried to do is he believed that if you could get 20 shots more per game than your opponent. And I think he felt like the magic number was about 100 shots. If they could get up 100 shots in 48 minutes and roughly get 20 more shots than their opponent, that was the formula that was required to be victorious. And so his teams played kind of the style of basketball that we see today. You know, he was kind of ahead of his time in that regard, and he doesn't get the credit for it.
Well, he also doesn't get, you know, what he also said, he said, cafeterias are my favorite place to eat out. A lot of people wouldn't be caught dead in a cafeteria. But where else can you inspect a prepared entree before ordering it? That is the great Doug Moe.
but do you agree with that? Inspecting, I mean, the entrees are not always desirable in a cafeteria setting. You know, the efficiency of the food is relatively low.
Yes, the food is so bad, but in such large portions.
If it's our ESPN cafeteria, then the quality is terrific in addition to that feature.
Well, that's certainly how we eat at the NBA every night, and let's just say that the food in the NBA arenas is, at least for the media, is not strong.
I came across that quote because I was looking for a Doug Moe quote where he actually talks about what you were talking about, which is that, you know, in his classic self-deprecating way, he's like, hey, people say we're last on defense. Yeah, we just have more possessions. I'm not a smart guy, but I know enough to know that points per game is a stupid stat. I mean, Doug Moe was the first guy publicly, you know, inside the game to say points per game is a stupid way to evaluate offense and defense. And so that was the quote I was looking for. And so I Googled Doug Moe quotes. Instead, I get a quote about a cafeteria.
Which makes sense because to take the serious tack here, you know who kind of popularized the idea of points per possession?
Mike D'Antoni.
No, Dean Smith, way back in the day.
Really?
At North Carolina,
okay.
Wrote about this in a book he did. They used it for years. So all of his former players who ended up becoming coaches in the NBA were kind of ahead of the curve on that.
I see. All right. So, Pelton, anything else got you interested?
I mean, we should probably talk about the Milwaukee Bucks and how dominant they've been. I mean, they got a great win last night in Denver. The fact that they've lost a couple close games, including overtime to the Clippers the day before at Staples, has maybe thrown people a little bit off the scent since they're second in the Eastern Conference, but in terms of point differential, you know, in terms of net rating, they're a hair ahead of the Golden State Warriors so far for number one in the NBA. And I think it's fascinating to ask the question of, you know, how sustainable their start is going to be.
Can I just take a 30-second timeout? It'll be longer than 30 seconds, but then again, so are 30-second timeouts in the NBA. And can I rail about League Pass right now? Do you guys have a problem with that? And I know that I'm probably going to hear from the league office on this, and I don't care. All right. I have a problem with League Pass. So last year, and this has actually been the case for a few years, I live in Omaha, Nebraska, and I know that nobody cares about Omaha, Nebraska in the NBA.
I care about Omaha, Nebraska.
But it points to a larger issue. And like, I have a friend who lives in Pittsburgh who can't watch the Cavs games. And he can't, you know, because he's got the same issue. All right. So I get some regional Oklahoma City Thunder games and some regional, Fox regional games of the Minnesota Timberwolves. It's the same channel. Some nights I get one, some nights I get the other. All of them are blacked out on League Pass. And when the spring comes around and there's Kansas City Royals preseason games, sometimes I get none of them and they're blacked out. All right. Well, this has been a burden. Now, this year, out of nowhere, for no reason I can understand, I don't get Denver Nuggets games. Good sirs, I am an 8-hour drive from Denver, Colorado. It is an hour and 25-minute flight. It's probably 500 miles. There is no possible way for me, you know, altitude is not available on my cable system whatsoever. And I am being blacked out of Denver Nuggets games. And last night I could not watch the Bucks Nuggets game because, it was blacked out. And, I just do not accept this as a reasonable thing for a premium paying customer. And unlike some people in the NBA who get it for free, I pay the full freight out of my own pocket for NBA League Pass. And I find it unacceptable that there are three teams, including a team that I have no chance to see that is 500 miles away, that I am being blacked out. And in this day and age with this technology, that is unacceptable. And I am furious about it, and I will not take any other way than it's being worked on immediately. That's all I have. Now, what do you want to say about the Bucks? Sorry.
Well, rightfully so. If you had to miss that game, it was a very entertaining game between the Bucks.
I have no idea what happened in the game. I know what was in the box score.
Well, Brook Lopez made 8 threes. I suppose you saw that in the box score. So unless Kevin wants to jump in here, I'll answer my own question to say that I think this is pretty sustainable from Milwaukee so far. One thing I've written about a little bit in the past is there's this interesting aspect, and Ben Falk wrote a really good piece about this a couple years ago during the playoffs for Cleaning the Glass, that, you know, kind of the things that make your shot selection efficient on offense tend to also work against your shot selection on defense, because usually you're playing small, you have a stretch four, all those sorts of things, and those kind of teams aren't as effective defensively. And Milwaukee this year so far seems to have cracked the code on, you know, having a really great shot distribution at both ends of the court. So they're third in terms of shot quality by the second spectrum metrics on offense, where they're also shooting quite a bit better than that because Lopez is off to such a hot start and Giannis and all that sort of thing. But defensively, they have the very best shot quality in the league. So I am inclined.
I mean, Kevin, it's profound. Because I'm a big fan of quantified shot probability, which also takes into account the second-second cut.
I'm a big fan of quantified shot probability.
But Brian, you would actually, this is, it is the most Brian Windhorst stat. And I'm going to tell you, you can ridicule me, Brian, as you rant against the presence of rectangular states in your midst that won't allow you to watch basketball. But what quantified shot probability not just takes into account the shot quality, but who is taking the shot. So, like, there are shots you would give up to, you know, Andre Roberson that you wouldn't give up to, say, Steph Curry. So, like, that particular stat, it's not in a vacuum. Like, it actually takes in the context, like, who is the guy that you're allowing to shop to? Milwaukee is farther ahead of number two Portland in that category defensively than the distance between number two Portland and number eight Orlando. Like, they are... Like, this is why I'm kind of bullish on them. Kevin, tell me if I'm wrong and kind of clamp down on my enthusiasm. But, like, they're doing kind of Warriors-y stuff from 2014 out 2015. I'm not suggesting they're about to rip off three out of four championships. But they are kicking the crap out of opponents.
Ready to predict that they're going to win three of the next four?
I am not ready to do that. But I do know that kicking the crap out of opponents – when you want to measure whether a team has staying power, am I correct, Kevin, is a pretty good indicator traditionally?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, you know, at this point of the season and really throughout, point differential is a better predictor of your win percentage going forward than your win percentage right. So far.
And they are the league leaders.
Yeah, and they've also had, you know, the early schedule I don't think was particularly challenging. They had a lot of home games at the start, but this was a brutal West Coast road trip that they went through. Portland, at Golden State, and then back to back at Clippers, at Denver, and to go 2-2 and, you know, have a pair of pretty lopsided, have a lopsided win, I guess, at Golden State in that slate was pretty impressive.
And what's even crazier is, they're giving up a shot quality below 50, which I just can't even recall seeing in the last couple of years. Like, that is, I mean, basically they are inviting teams to just basically turn in terrible offensive performance. They are giving teams no opportunity for high percentage shooting on a possession by possession basis.
They are averaging 41 three-pointer attempts per game, which is number one in the league, and just 30 two-point attempts. Brook Lopez is averaging 7 three-point attempts per game. Is this sustainable for them? Are they going to continue to shoot 42 threes a game? Can Brook Lopez – now, Brook Lopez is shooting 42%. He's basically making 3 out of every 7 threes that he's taking per game. Can Brook Lopez continue to make 3 three-pointers a game? I don't know. Maybe he can. I'm just saying, like, one of the things about this Bucks team that was people thought they weren't going to be able to do is shoot. That was their supposed downfall. And they've still got some guys out there who are suspect. You know, Giannis is a terrible outside shooter. He's shooting 7% on the season from three-point range. He's not taking that many, but nonetheless. Their rookie, Dante DiVincenzo, he's shooting 25% to shooting 4 three-pointers a game. Can this volume keep up to create the kind of spacing that Giannis is using to be able to get to the rim?
I don't think the volume – I think the volume will stay up. I don't think they'll keep shooting quite this well. DiVincenzo is maybe the one guy, and maybe Eric Bledsoe, who are due to shoot a little bit better than they have so far. But, you know, Middleton's at 46%. Brogdon's 44%. Lopez, as you mentioned, 42%. Even John Henson at 38, which is one of the most improbable developments of this season, that John Henson is both shooting and making three-pointers, despite the fact that he's also been a Hack-a-Shaq candidate in the past. I think that's a first in NBA history to have that particular combination
right.
of skills. Yeah, but I think they'll settle back down a little bit. Their offense probably won't stay quite this good, but I think they're going to keep shooting him. I mean, Bud is very committed to it, and Brook Lopez, he's like firing with reckless abandon from three. That,
clearly.
I guess, what you didn't see not watching the game last night is, you know, the last three he made, I think, it was the last, at least in the stretch, where he was going nuts. He made a three from the hash mark. I mean, I've never seen a seven-footer shoot from out there.
Did he point at the ground? Did you see this last night, Trae Young?
Trae yes.
Young hit a three from like maybe 30 feet, 32 feet in LA, yeah. and he pointed at the ground like, remember, this is where I shot it from. That's why.
Okay,
he also
so
airballed the three late in the game. Kevin, yeah, do you, because you know a lot about Coach Bud, has he used these squares? Do you know about these practice court squares before?
I am going up there in a few weeks, but I know of the practice squares. I cannot confirm nor deny whether there are squares in the Bucks facility.
Oh, there are. That I can confirm.
All right, then you can confirm that.
So, do you know about this technique? I'm not saying he's the only one who does it.
No, educate me. I do not know about this technique.
So apparently, you know, they have this beautiful brand new practice facility in Milwaukee, and the first thing Bud did was order the court to be defaced, and they put down these squares that basically he wants these players to be within these squares as they practiced offense. And in theory, when you know the concept transfers over to a game, that the player make sure that in his mind he's in this square, because it, you know, he puts them on the court. I think they're probably taped down, I know that they're like purple or blue on the court so that they stand out. And the concept is that the player has got to remain in that zone, sort of his own zone, to absolutely make sure that there's spacing. Because one of the things that happens during games is players float a little bit or they maneuver or whatever, and the spacing breaks down. And so the concept is to do muscle memory and to do court memory, that as they practice, these guys have to stay in these squares on offense. And it sort of, you know, keeps them remembering to consistently and constantly stretch the floor. I'm not saying that Bud came up with it, but this is something that he brought to their day in and day out practice technique that, you know, reinforces the concept of always, always, always thinking about spacing.
Which, to your point, when you have Giannis Antetokounmpo as your offensive centerpiece, a guy who doesn't offer range, it is imperative that the guys around him actually are space, because, you know, that guy in and of himself, his spacing is essentially vertical, and you know, everybody else, it's kind of east west. I mean, there needs to be, I mean, he needs a layer of space around him. He doesn't need that big of a layer because he's just freaky. What's interesting is Kevin, let me ask you a question. So I'm looking at kind of what I call the lucky column on Second Spectrum, which are teams that are overperforming the quality of the shots they're getting. Am I correct to assume teams that might regress, or for that matter, teams that have gotten some rough luck early on? And I think I remember Orlando being one of these teams early last year when they came out to that jackrabbit start, that
yep.
You'd look at these columns and like, eh, this isn't real. Because I have right now is, if you go to the QSM column, I have as our, quote, luckiest teams, Sacramento, Milwaukee, Golden State, Charlotte, Indiana, as sort of the top five teams whose shot probability is their effective field goal percentage is that much better than the expected shot.
Yeah, and so one thing I haven't looked at is, you know, again, you're using the version that takes into account who's doing the shooting in addition to just where the shots are coming from, and I'm not sure, you know, when those two that discrepancy starts to become meaningful, because, you know, the season long average that it's based on right now is still only a handful.
Well, because this is why I use that column. And I'll tell you, there's a story behind why I use that column. When you use the regular column that doesn't take into account, every single season the Golden State Warriors outperform their
right.
Because it's because they don't take into account who Steph Curry is, who Klay Thompson is. So I always found that, like, this isn't really useful. All this tells me is the Golden State Warriors make shots they have no business making. Well, of course, look at the personnel. So I like to go over to this other column that says, yeah, let's take into account who these guys are. And then all of a sudden it flattens it a little bit. And it gives you, at least for me, and you're far, far, far infinitely more advanced than I am in this area, but I just found that, like, if I keep going to that stat and keep seeing that, oh, guess what? The Golden State Warriors are the team in the league that are most outperforming their shot quality. That's not telling me anything that I don't know.
Right.
Right? It's just telling me that just they're unconscious and they've been so for 5 years.
Yeah, as I look at it right now, I think it does a better job of matching kind of my conventional sense of who's playing over their head, starting with, you know, you mentioned Sacramento as the leader in that category. And they're a team that, well, I think, you know, the way they're playing under Dave Yeager, the just pushy at every single opportunity with this relentless pace that wears teams down almost defensively has helped them. I mean, still, I'm unconvinced that, you know, Buddy Hield is going to stay the most efficient, you know, outside the most efficient high scorer in the league, and that De'Aaron Fox has improved as much as we've seen from last year. I mean, Milwaukee is benefiting a little bit, but then, you know, still in terms of quantified shot probability has, you know, one of the six best shot distributions. So I think they're going to stay really good offensively. The Clippers are maybe a team we should touch on. Andrew Hahn's beloved Clippers, because they're a team that seems to have benefited from, you know, probably some better than expected shooting at the offensive end of the court and then worse than expected shooting at the defensive end of the court.
Andrew, everybody loves an underdog story. Don't you love an underdog story?
I love dogs, so maybe I'll love this too.
Do you have a favorite underdog of all time? Is it Joel Embiid? Never starting even organized basketball to like 2009 and becoming one of the best players in the NBA just a few years later.
Yeah, is that's a good one.
The Cavs coming back from 3-1 down in the 2016 finals.
Oh, that's a great one.
That's a classic underdog story. How about the underdog story of Simply Safe? Now, you may say to yourself, what does a security system have to do with an underdog story? Well, I'm glad you were thinking that, Andrew, because I'm going to tell you. Like a decade ago, if you wanted a security system, you had to go through like these huge companies. They made you sign these expensive long-term contracts and all these fees, and their systems were outdated. But that was when Simply Safe started, and they started in a kitchen from an electrical engineer. He was a guy named Chad Lorenz, and he was like, I don't want to do it the same way. I want to have my own style of security system that I'm going to just make for me and my friends. And he also didn't want to treat people poorly like some of these security systems do. And now, like, Simply Safe is ubiquitous. You see it all over the place. It's like all these magazines and rating systems have it as their top choice for home security. And they're no longer an underdog. There's now over 2 million people that trust this system to keep them safe. Not bad for a security company that started off in a kitchen. So, Andrew, I think you should protect your home with Simply Safe today and support our show, The Hoop Collective, by ordering your system at simplysafe.com/hoop. Let them know we sent you, please. That's simplysafe.com/hoop. Simplysafe.com/hoop.
That's exactly what I was thinking about, Brian. How did you know that I was wondering about this?
Well, you know, we live in complicated times, and sometimes we all need a little security. The Celtics come in to the week, I believe, 27th in offense. I think that's where they're at. Really struggling in certain aspects of it. And certainly we expected Gordon Hayward to struggle a little bit. I just can't believe that, you know, he's shooting less than 40% from the field. But their functionality as an offense has really been down. Jason Tatum, who I expected to have a really great year, has his isolations are up. Their overall team is down, and you know they lost again last night. I think they're only a game over 500. And granted, they've had a bit of a challenging schedule so far. But what do you guys see from the Celtics? Is this small sample size maybe making them look worse than they actually are?
I think probably a little bit worse. I think, you know, their shot quality hasn't been great either early in the season. You mentioned Tatum's isolations. They're playing a lot one-on-one, relying probably more than they should on long twos. And, you know, Brad Stevens had a quote after last night's game. I think, so on this road trip, they've trailed by at least 13 points going into the fourth quarter of all three games. And then they ended up winning the Phoenix game in overtime, a semi-miraculous comeback, and their comebacks fell efforts fell short.
I'm going to go ahead and give it miraculous. I'm going to call that miraculous, not even semi-miraculous. It was miraculous.
Well, the fact that it's the Suns were the opponent, that's why it's only semi-miraculous.
But,
you know, he was like, well, we need to find a way to play with the same level of urgency for all four quarters. But I think the other thing that stood out watching that Blazers-Celtics game second half closely last night was their shot distribution got way better in the second half, too. All of a sudden, they started taking a bunch of threes, and it turns out those are better shots than the isolations and long twos. And then they kind of went back to that and down the stretch and lost the ball movement, and all of a sudden, their comeback attempt fell apart. So, you know, I think that's got to be kind of part of the challenge is how do we get this team to share the ball and shoot efficient shots all game long instead of just doing it when we fall behind. And, you know, it's kind of, I wonder if Jason Tatum might have gotten a little gassed up based on what happened in last year's playoffs.
Yeah, I also saw he had been working out with Kobe Bryant over the summer, who told him to, quote, shoot every time. And while I think we can have a more protracted debate about Kobe and his legacy and all the rest of it, and not the day or time for that, you know, Kobe might, for a guy working kind of in a system, kind of still establishing habits, like maybe not the best advice or kind of tactical handbook if you're trying to create an efficient offensive offense.
Let me just take, again, 30-second timeout. This is why Kevin Arnovitz is who he is. Maybe, you know, quote, maybe not the best tactical handbook. Go on.
I don't know that you want to Mamba up that offense right now. You know, it's predicated on so many different guys with such multiple skill sets. I mean, you got to utilize Al Horford. You know, probably one of the best facilitating bigs. I mean, obviously Kyrie's the best. I think, I mean, Kevin, there's a statistic for this, but I mean, among the best finishing shot makers in the league. I mean, just ISO for ISO, but like, you know, Tatum, I think worked really well last year because he worked within a system. Granted, the defenses weren't game planning for him, but he was an important cog in a relatively, they were not all that good offensively last year, but he worked, that offense was systematized. And what I see in the first half of these games, I mean, I watched that first half in Portland from the press room last night in Los Angeles. And I mean, that was like the Ricky Davis All-Stars. I'm like, this is the Boston Celtics?
Pelton.
Who were the Ricky Davis All-Stars once upon a time?
Yes.
Right.
They were.
That's right. Al Horford is not playing well. He's got the lowest PER of his career, I believe since his rookie year, early on this season. His shooting percentages are as low as they've been pretty much since his rookie year. He's shooting down under 30% on three-pointers while taking the most three-pointers of his career. He's averaging just 12 points a game, which is the lowest since his second season. Anomaly, or is this Al not getting taken care of in the offense, or what? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's probably a part of it. I mean, everything I mentioned earlier about, you know, they need to play with ball movement and avoid isolations. Well, that's a much better system for Al Horford. The ISO system isn't going to do much for him. I think the 3-point shooting is probably pretty fluky in the early going. He's probably not the 43% shooter he was last year. He's probably, you know, closer to the 36% he shot in his career, but I doubt he's the 28% shooter we've seen so far this season. And that's probably going to help the Celtics when that happens as well.
The Houston Rockets, what are we seeing in their situation that you think will improve or stay difficult?
Well, to go back to Kevin's quantified shot making tab on Second Spectrum, the Houston Rockets are last, and also by a wide margin. They're making 4.7%, shooting 4.7% worse than you'd expect based on, you know, the shot quality and who's taking those shots. No one else in the league is below 3.4%. Oklahoma City, who really started slowly but has started to recover a little bit. So, you know, I think they're inevitably going to shoot the ball better than they have. I think I'm curious, you know, Chris Paul, how much of this is the elbow, how much of this is small sample size, and how much of this is him maybe taking a step backwards as he gets into deeper into his 30s. I mean, I think that's probably the question much more than Melo or anything like else that's anything like that that's going to determine what the rest of their season look like.
You know, when you start ranking the, hey, if you wanted to give fan bases hope, I like to look to that column, right? And Houston would be one, as Pelton mentioned. OKC, the Cavs, for whatever it's worth. The Pistons haven't shot the ball as well as they should have. Boston is actually the fifth team on that list. You know who's not, like, all that far up that list? Are the Washington Wizards. Like if you were looking for optimism and saying, hey, they've just been cold, like, you would not go to the Wizards. And they're pretty much within a point of where you'd expect them to be offensively. And I just wonder, Kevin, like, when we look at small sample size theater, are the Wizards just bad? Is it just possible that they're just, that this is not, oh, they're better than this, the component parts, the chemistry, that are they just a bad basketball team?
I don't think they're a bad, well, they're a bad basketball team if they have this level of effort. I mean, they are. You know, their shot making on defense, opponents have probably been a little hotter than you'd expect. Yeah. Based on their shot profile. But, you know, I mean, I think the big question offensively is just kind of, you know, is John Wall still at that star level where he can be the focal point of a really good offense?
He better be, Pelton. He's got a $200 million extension kicking in next year.
Right. That's what I was leading up to. And Zach Lowe wrote about this last week, is sort of their dilemma of, you know, is there even, if they wanted to trade John Wall, is there anyone who would actually take him on that contract? And it's not real clear that there is.
Well, I can tell you that the answer to that is no. I mean, you know, only if they send back a contract that is humongous to Washington. If you're asking me, how could Washington trade John Wall under the current contractual issues, which are, he's owed a huge amount of money, plus he's owed a trade kicker that would be in the tens of millions, I believe, if he were to be traded. I don't see how they could make a deal and get and retrofit their team. I think that's a non-starter. Maybe in a year from now, when he's into that contract and the trade kicker changes a little bit, maybe we can have a discussion. I just don't think that's a feasible discussion right now. What about Philadelphia? They now have made a major adjustment to their team, bringing in Jimmy Butler. They are not ranking very well as a team from an efficiency standpoint. What is your evaluation on what that will mean for them?
Yeah, I know Kevin had flagged them as a team to look at based on the fact that they've been scoring more efficiently this season with Ben Simmons on the bench. And that's a case where I think if you look at the shot quality, it's pretty clearly a case of just kind of randomness in shooting early in the season. You know, they've outperformed their shot quality with faults on the court and underperformed it with Simmons on the bench. And, you know, there's no, even though Simmons himself is a little bit a part of that, he's underperformed his shot quality in a way that he didn't last season, even with his unwillingness to shoot from the perimeter. But, you know, I don't think that's likely something that's going to continue. And then also now we've got this question of just kind of what are they going to look like? How different are they going to look with Jimmy Butler in the lineup and without Dario Saric, who was one of those players who was underperforming and was probably due to play better? I think, you know, that actually was probably the best part of this trade for the Sixers, is the fact that they traded Saric when he was struggling so much, because they were bound to play a little better either way. And now it's going to look like it's because of the Jimmy Butler trade and not just because they've regressed to the mean.
I always find that... Oh, I'm sorry, Brian.
No, please go ahead.
I always find kind of two starters for one starter. Obviously, Butler's the best player in the deal. It's unquestionable. There's always interesting to evaluate, and Pelton, you probably have to do this, which is, for practical effect, if we're looking at what did the Sixers get and what did they give up, they traded Saric and Covington, and let's forget the peripheral assets right now, for Butler and whoever else is going to take those minutes who might already be on their roster, right? Like, when you evaluate a trade, you start projecting forward. What you're taking are Covington's minutes and Saric's minutes, tossing them out, bringing in Butler's minutes, and then whatever else, like that replacement player. And maybe if they get Redick back on the floor with the starters and they kind of go small and Simmons plays the defensive four, but the offensive one, you know, maybe there's some other guys in the roster, maybe Wilson Chandler as he gets healthier. becomes that guy. But that's the big question for me is, A, to your extent, what is – it's because you said earlier, what is it going to look like? Just very basically, they're a very unconventional offensive team, right? They play pick and roll less than any team in the league. They are a really interesting kind of mosaic of styles, and you got the old post ups to Embiid, but you got a lot of motion sets, and then you got this weird thing where their backcourt doesn't shoot, which is a completely non current thing.
That's a weird thing indeed. Yeah,
you know, and so. And then Butler, who's this somewhat more conventional wing, right? Athletic wing who can make plays off the bounce for himself, occasionally for others. So that's the big question for me is, what does it look like from a scheme standpoint, but like who takes those minutes? Do we definitively know what the closing lineup, of the Philadelphia 76ers is going to be? Simmons' role changes a bit, I think, now.
I think Fultz's role changes too, such as it is. In talking to people in the league since the deal, a lot of executives believe that the Sixers have another trade coming. Whether or not they have it arranged yet or whether or not they're going to have to do it because, as you mentioned, their team's a little bit unbalanced. They're missing a power forward now. And it depends on, again, I do think it depends on what Wilson Chandler does for them, but they now have one too many two guards. They already were dealing with Fultz and Redick awkwardness. Now they introduce one of the better two guards in the league. The guy is going to play, 37 minutes. They have too many two guards and not enough power forwards. Seems to me that a two guard for power forward trade is out there in the offing. And what that is, we'll see in the coming weeks. But you can see, just as you're sort of doing some gymnastics there, Arnovitz, to try to figure it out, having Ben Simmons want to defend power forwards and stuff like that, I don't know how that's going to fly.
Boy, how different would this team, and especially post the Jimmy Butler trade?
I know where you're going with this.
Signed Nemanja Bjelica over the summer, as they thought they had done. And he's not going to keep shooting 50-plus from three as he did for the Kings early this season, one reason that they've been outperforming their numbers so far. But he would be able to slide into that Šarić spot and give you relatively similar production at a great value if they had actually
That's a small sample size theater, too, Bjelica's performance for the Kings so far. But that was such a strange story. I don't know how many people you'd really would have been paying close to the attention to the NBA to know about this. He signed a 1-year deal, he didn't sign it. He agreed to it. How much was it for? Do you remember? Like $4.5 million?
It would have been for the room mid level. So,
which is 4.5, right? Isn't that right?
4.45.
Okay. So then he backs out of the agreement and tells the Sixers, if I'm not mistaken, that he wanted to go play in Europe. That after being in the NBA for a couple of years, he misses Europe, he misses his family, he's going to go back and play in Europe. And the Sixers are like, all right, well, you've put us in a tough spot here. We planned our team around having you. But we don't want an unhappy player on our team. We'll let you out of the commitment. And then they ended up going and making the Wilson Chandler move where they absorbed him into space. I don't think it was necessarily
the Chandler move either first or simultaneously. That's where they used their space. And then, they were going to use their post space room mid-level on Bjelica.
All right. Well, anyway, Bjelica backs out and then a few days, it wasn't that much time, was it?
So he gave an interview to, I want to say it was The Athletic. I think it must have been John Krasinski for The Athletic, where he said that, if you parse the words very carefully, he said, I don't want to move my family around. I would either like a long-term deal in the NBA or to go back to Europe. And then lo and behold, he gets a 3-year deal from the Kings.
And how much, but it was only 2 years guaranteed. Am I correct in saying that?
That is correct, yes.
And it was for more money, but not dramatically more.
It was pretty dramatically. I mean, 6.5 this year, 6.825 next year.
Okay. So, so he gets a 2-year guarantee versus a 1-year guarantee, and he gets $13 million guaranteed as opposed to $4.5 million guaranteed. So basically, he just, he, you know, What I would have said to him is, well, if you wanted a longer term offer, then why did you agree to a 1 year deal? You know, I mean, do you remember when this happened with John Salmons? Do you guys remember this one, Kevin Arnovitz? Do you remember this?
Was this when he was in Chicago?
I do not remember that.
He committed to signing with the Raptors. Then he backed out of the deal because he said God told him not to sign there.
Well, very different than when God told Allen Iverson to choose Memphis.
Right.
Can you imagine if there is indeed a God, but he only spoke to basketball players about contractual matters?
Well, but then Salmons also signed in Sacramento for more money. So this is twice in the last like decade where the Kings have benefited, like all the things that go against the Kings.
Well,
how about
three times? Because Yogi Ferrell. I don't know if we know if that was divinely inspired.
Right. That's right, Yogi Ferrell. What is going on with this?
Well, I'll tell you what's going on. Right, like the cap management is so Byzantine and so complicated that you know you. There's always this trust, right? Which is these guys agree to these deals, but there's certain cap gymnastics that have to go on. Hey, sit tight. We want to work you into this slot, but we first have to go take care of these other things in sequence in order to be able to afford. And everybody to kind of just trust that everybody before anybody picks up a pen to sign a contract.
You're right.
You know, Philadelphia knew they want to be a Lisa and they want, but they needed to use their cap and you know, sit tight. They trust them. And then Sacramento swoops in. And if you, depending on who you talk to in the league, it's always a very interesting thing. Like, is all fair in love and war? Did Sac come in and kind of violate the unwritten codes of free agency? Or, hey, Philly, you know, if you want a guy, you gotta because sign on the dotted line, do whatever preparations you need to within the framework of your cap to get it done. And but Philly had to go out do these gymnastics, and yeah.
All right, before we go, but I agree with you that not having Bielitsa is dramatically affecting the 76ers. But you think, Pelton, that the 76ers will – this trade will signal a – I mean, you know, they're not a 500 team. They're 8-6, but you think that this will catapult them?
I think a little bit. I mean, I think – you know, the interesting thing to go back to Kevin's original point about the minutes they've lost and how they're going to fill them is that, you know, it's partially because RPM has rated Robert Covington so highly and probably more highly than I think any of us would just subjectively. But, you know, I plugged the new lineups into the original preseason projections and Philly actually, I think, dropped a little bit rather than improving despite getting, you know, the best player in the trade in Jimmy Butler just because of the fact that you've got so many minutes that we're going to quality starters that now are either going to Chandler, of whom I'm a skeptic, or lower even on the rotation than that, because this is a team with a lot of injury question marks. And at this point, you know, 10 guys you can really count on to play rotation caliber minutes. So I think you have to go out, as you said. I think this has to be the precursor to something else. And one of the things that I think is going to be really fascinating over the next couple of months, I feel like where Kyle Korver goes could end up like having a massive impact on the Eastern Conference, assuming it's one of those contenders.
Well, right. But hey. Philly still has some expiring contracts they can do business with. They have Chandler, they have Mike Muscala, they have Redick, although Redick can block a trade. But we talked about this in the pod over the weekend. Yes, Mr. Arnovitz, what were you saying?
I want to ask Pelton, and for that matter you, because it's a team you follow. So if you look at the Minnesota Timberwolves, and obviously they lost an impact player, their best player, in terms of production, if not potential. You look at that starting five, and you know what? It's kind of interesting. In Covington, they get the kind of player they've been missing for a very long time. A starting 3-4 who, when he's, can shoot a little bit and might be one of the most versatile defenders in the league at his position. What if they get good Dario? Okay, to put next to Towns. The Wiggins is obviously always going to be this issue we have to deal with, potential versus production. You know, Jeff Teague's been hurt in and out, but they're getting good production from Rose. Like, is it crazy to say that they're still very much in playoff contention when you add up all the pieces? And and, you know, look at obviously the talent of Towns and just what they get now defensively with Covington. And Sarge, by the way, is not a terrible defender at all.
Well, I think they got to play Derrick Rose less. Derrick Rose is playing too much.
No, and it would be coming back, let's say.
Yeah, Teague is getting close to coming back. One of the things I think benefits them is, yes, they're 4-9, but the West isn't – there's a lot of teams sort of puttering in the West. They've dropped in the standings, but it's not like there's seven teams in the West that are already six games over 500. So they have some window where if they start to play better – they can, you know, because this is one of the things I thought at the start of the season was, if you had a bad 2 weeks in the West, it would take you 2 months to overcome it. But you have New Orleans sputtering, you have Houston sputtering, the Lakers are 500. A few teams have impressed us, you know, but the Jazz sputtering, the Thunder came out of the box sputtering a little bit. The Spurs are, you know, okay, but only a little bit above 500. So I think they've got a fighting shot on that. But, Pelton, unless you have something really to say here, I just want to squeeze in before we go. So the Raptors are 12-1. They've done it despite Kawhi missing some games. Are they number one in point differential?
They're actually – They're behind Milwaukee in the East, and then also behind Golden State, and I think they might be behind someone else too.
What do we think about the Raptors? I mean, are they going to be a 65 win team? I mean, what do we think about?
They're tied with Portland for third.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. I mean, my takeaway from watching them the other
real quick, Portland has had a preposterous home road imbalance. I mean, they're doing great. I think they've played 9 home games and 4 road games so far. So just they're small sample size on that. But okay, sorry, I will shut up. Go ahead on to Toronto.
Although still, I mean, in the West, you feel like Portland, who knows, they could be the second best team in the West, because who knows who that is at this point. Toronto, but I was watching them their matinee yesterday or Saturday against New York, and the takeaway was this team is almost boring in how good they are, because of the fact that, you know, the Knicks can maybe hang around for a quarter or two, or, you know, just be in the game, and then Kawhi will get a steal and turn it into a layup at the other end, and, you know, Fred VanVleet will hit a three, or Danny Green will hit a three, and they just have so many good players that they're just going to kind of grind teams down. And I think, you know, despite what I said about Milwaukee earlier and their point differential and how excited I am about them, I still think Toronto is the heavy favorite to finish with the best record in the Eastern Conference, and, you know, maybe a decent chance at finishing with the best record in the NBA.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I love them is I was looking at sort of, so they have this three-man unit of Lowry, Green, and Leonard, and then it's like, okay, who do you put around them? Do you do the conventional bigs? So you got Valanciunas, you have Ibaka, who's a little bouncy or not as conventional, but still that. You could do Anunoby and shift Leonard up to the four. Siakam has been a revelation. He's a really versatile, kind of really unique player with the skill set to kind of downsize or upsize, and it doesn't matter. Like, they are killing teams no matter who those other two guys. And what I love about a team in this day and age is they can be whoever they want to be. They want to be the conventional big team with two bigs? Fine. Great. You want to be the small ball Leonard at the four? Fine. You want to have five shooters out there with Siakam as the only, quote, big? Fine. You want to pair that? And that's what I love about Toronto, is they can be whoever they want to be on a given possession, on a given night, in a given quarter. And that's why I just think they're so strong.
Siakam is shooting 63% from the field so far. Just hunting down good shots, because he's not a good outside shooter.
He takes no bad shots.
Right. When he has a shot, he takes it. When he doesn't have a shot, he looks to create. Yeah. They are in the bottom half of the league in three-point percentage. There's a couple of guys on their team who are not shooting the ball. Like, you know, Lowry is under 40%. CJ Miles has been terrible from three-point range so far. He's a guy who runs hot and cold. Anunoby and Fred VanVleet, two guys that you expect to shoot the ball good, you know, better than they have been from 3-point range. Ibaka is shooting a much less volume of 3-pointers, but his percentage is also down. So if you're looking for where they could improve, maybe they're actually not shooting as well as they can from 3-point range, and maybe that number will actually increase. I mean, I look at them and they've also had a reasonably difficult schedule. The one thing about Milwaukee, Boston and Toronto, they've all made their first West Coast trip. Sometimes you see these teams that haven't gone West yet and their schedule's a little bit inflated. You know, Milwaukee's record is what it is. Toronto was 12-1 and they've already been to the West. Now, granted, they didn't play all the hardest teams out there, but they played a road back to back in Salt Lake and kicked Salt Lake's tail.
Without
Kawhi. That's one of the things that's impressive about me is the schedule also favors Toronto after, you know, with this start.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, they're just a really impressive team. And I think the one important thing about the good start, you know, Kevin mentioned the way they're rotating guys in and out of the starting lineup in the front court. I feel like if you're struggling, that's going to get really frustrating in a hurry. But if you're 12-1 and everything's going great, it's hard to be upset about that.
All right. I can't believe this player is going to keep it up, or I expect this guy to rally massively. Is there anything like that's still in your notebook that's sticking way out?
Kevin, you want to go?
Domantas Sabonis is the best player in the NBA. It is for real. That is large sample size theater. This guy is outrageous now. That's my favorite of the early season small sample size theater items. He's a very nice player, but obviously he will not keep this up. But look, the quality of his play is sort of one of the things that I think is keeping Indiana's who was one of those, it was last year an outlier teams. Yeah, kind of squarely in the middle of the pack in the East.
You stole mine, Kevin, because his PER is 26.3 right now.
He's a monster.
Which is like, it's not quite MVP level, but that's like all NBA level PER. He's shooting 68% from the field to this point. No three-pointers. Let's just shoot threes. Just, again, hunts good shots. Certainly a most improved candidate, but that was a guy who I'm like every single night. In fact, I even told Andrew Hahn the other day, I go, I'm looking for him in the box score every night just to see what he's doing. But Pelton, is there somebody for you?
Yeah, Sabonis, I broke that down. His shot quality so far this year has been 1.8% better than last year in terms of like the effective field goal percentage. His shot making has been 14% better. So,
okay, so
little I see what you're saying.
So sell that stock, Brian.
Yeah. Okay, damn.
And Miles Turner's probably going to shoot better than 12.5% on threes this year. So the gap between those two guys might close up. I mean, do we want to talk about, on the other end of the spectrum, do we want to talk about Brandon Ingram and whether he's going to continue to kind of scuffle along as he has in this new role alongside LeBron?
He doesn't, beyond his statistics, he looks miserable. Not that I'm an expert in Brandon Ingram body language, because I haven't watched him a heck of a lot, but he just looks miserable at times out there.
And it's a really hard transition for guys who play that position. I mean, Brian, you know this. I'm very bullish on Brandon Ingram just in general in skill set. I thought he made amazing strides last year. I still think he might be their second best player, but it's really hard to figure this out, isn't it? I mean, playing with LeBron is a privilege and it is a challenge, and especially that he has been evolving a certain way in a very specific scheme for his entire career. And now this happens, and it is just a seismic shift. It is rearranging all the furniture in your house, and you are walking around blindfolded.
And it's not so good because the Lakers really need to increase his value in, certainly to play with LeBron, but in theory, if a trade becomes available in the next, 6 to 8 months, let's just call it what it is. Let's say Anthony Davis becomes available. You want to be able to have that piece to offer, and you don't want to be offering him when he's coming off of his worst year, not his best year.
Where do you think that is right now? Have you talked to people? I mean, are there still, you know, strong Brandon Ingram believers who think he's a, you know, multi-time future all-star?
There's an executive that I have a long-term relationship with who was a big Brandon Ingram fan when he came out of Duke, told me that he felt like he was going to be a world-class scorer. And we've had this sort of back and forth. And, you know, I was not a believer in Brandon Ingram. And then his second half of last year, he was really good, right? I mean, he was really making progress. And the guy was like, I told you. And then, you know, by the time he's in year three, he's going to get his feet up underneath him. And, you know, the guy was lording over me. And now he's like, it's not working with LeBron. And you know, he doesn't really want to blame Ingram. You know, I think he's more concerned about where he is with LeBron.
So I think that's the encouraging thing for the Lakers if they are thinking about it in terms of his trade value. If kind of that LeBron factor ends up getting the explanation for this, then maybe teams will continue to value him like they did before.
Well, it's not good either way. All right, thank you guys for joining us for small sample size. Is there a point in the season where we can say this is large sample size theater? When is that threshold?
I mean, there's no one point, you know, people, they kind of look for that. But I think, you know, at the team level in particular, 20 games by that point, it starts to pretty well shake out.
All right, Andrew, put us down your calendar. The last week of the season in April, we're going to have large sample size theater.
Isn't that just the standings?
Yes. Thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast. What are they supposed to do,
Brian
Andrew?
Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective. Subscribe, rate, and review. Is that what it is?
Yes. So I should go subscribe. Is what you're saying?
To this one, at least.
All right. Thanks for listening.